What is in that southern soil that makes Virginians grow so tall?
The seeds of liberty, Monroe said, with a quickness he'd lacked as a younger man.
And what brings you to New York? I asked. He stooped to give my hand a very gentlemanly kiss.
Virginia has sentenced me to serve here in Congress.
You poor wretch, I said with a laugh, glad that Congress was now meeting in New York City. I led him into the kitchen where we set straight away to brewing coffee to ward off the winter's chill. I shouldn't have invited a gentleman into the house with such familiarity, but in Monroe's case, I could scarcely think my husband would mind.
The coffee was roasted already by the grocer, the Virginian said, shaking the bag and offering to pound the beans to a powder if I could provide him with a mortar and pestle.
I didn't tell him how appalled my mother would be, for she insisted that a good housekeeper always roasted her own coffee beans, but instead showed him the little coffee grinder Angelica had sent me from France. Monroe and I fell into easy conversation as he gallantly turned the silver handle upon the mill, and at some point in our reminiscing, he mentioned having written me a letter before he left Valley Forge.
The letter must have miscarried, I said, embarrassed that he thought I'd neglected to reply.
But letters miscarried all the time during war, as he had good cause to know.
I never received it. Why didn't you write again?
Monroe chuckled. Fearing I'd made a fool of myself, I couldn't work up the nerve.
I smiled fondly, remembering how shy he'd been in those days. But he seemed far bolder now. How is it that you're still unmarried?
Monroe gave a good-natured shrug. Well, for one thing, I'm a poor, unpaid soldier, having inherited from my father only a small Virginia farm with barren fields turned to dust by tobacco.
Then he looked up at me with those soulful gray eyes and added,
For another thing, the girl I loved married another man.
Ordinarily, I was not so vain to have dared imagine that he meant me, especially since Burr told me Monroe had a sweetheart in Christina Wincoop, daughter of a Pennsylvania congressman. But the way Monroe now stared at me, blushing to the tips of his ears, made me so uncomfortable that the two of us stood there, like mute blockheads. Fortunately, we were rescued by a knock at the back door. It was Theodosia Burr, bundled in a fur-lined cloak.
I thought I saw James Monroe at the end of the street.
As it happened, Theodosia had hosted Monroe when he was in the service of Lord Stirling, so another happy reunion took place in my kitchen. And when Monroe asked her advice on finding a wife in the city, she said,
You're a congressman now, an important man of the people. The ladies will flock to you, given your accomplishments.
Monroe gave a belly laugh.
We never accomplish anything in Congress. We couldn't pass Mr. Jefferson's land ordinance for admitting new states to the Union because it bans slavery after the year 1800. We couldn't pass Mr. Jefferson's proposal to make the dollar a national currency. We can't agree on a site for our nation's capital, or even if we are a nation or a collection of states.
Hamilton shares your frustration, I said, readying the hot water in its pot over the stove. It's why he's not in Congress anymore.
Monroe raised a brow. My friend must have changed very much since the war if he is now content with drudgery at the bar while the country slides into disorder.
Oh, Colonel Hamilton is never content about anything, Theodosia replied with an indulgent smile. He's never at home. Why, it grieves my poor heart to know how often poor Betsy is left alone.
Theodosia wasn't wrong. Even when Alexander was pacing our bedroom, practicing some argument at court, he was somewhere else. But it seemed a shrewish complaint about a man who was striving to provide for me and my children, and I didn't want Monroe to think badly of him, so I rushed to his defense.
Why, I'm not alone at all. Between fine visitors such as yourselves and my beautiful children, my days are filled. And honestly,
Hamilton wouldn't be the man I married without his sense of duty. Besides, my husband's work defending Tories had made his law practice thrive. But I didn't want to explain that to Monroe, who had little cause to know about our financial circumstances or how severely persecuted our neighbors were.
"I've heard Hamilton has helped to found a bank," Monroe said.
I nodded. Amidst all his legal cases, Alexander had written the new bank's constitution and become actively involved in its organization.
"The Bank of New York, just down the street. He hopes to address the derangement of our financial situation in the city."
"Which reminds me," Theodosia said, pulling a folded broadsheet from her handbag.
"You might wish to show this to Hamilton."
Inwardly, I groaned, not needing to read it to know what it would say, for the New York papers vilified my husband daily for helping the persecuted Tories. He'd built his reputation on heroism, but now reaped the bitter seeds of a different sort of fame, and the unfairness of it pained me. Having seen my father accused of treason, I was acutely sensitive to public censure. And because it set my husband's temper on edge and fired his combative nature to see his name blackened in the press, it had become my regular practice to burn the papers that came to the house, charging him with helping the most abandoned scoundrels in the universe. I was trying to decide where to hide Theodosia's paper until I could dispose of it, when she eyed the brewing coffee and said,
"That's going to take forever. We should go to a coffee house."
Monroe, who had probably spent all he had to acquire the coffee beans, looked crestfallen. So I ventured forth with, "It's so cold that I prefer to make coffee at home, and while we're waiting, let me treat the both of you to some of my homemade waffles," I said, pulling out the Dutch waffle irons just like Mama's that she'd given me as a present. "Reuniting with old friends is worthy of celebration."
"Waffles?" Beaming, Monroe grinned. "You remembered."
"I can't promise they'll be the same as your mammy's," I said, laughing again at the memory of how he'd blurted out his craving to me all those years ago. "But I'll slather them in butter." Theodosia rolled her eyes, but settled in at the table and assisted me as I prepared the old family recipe and heated the irons.
"At least come out with us tonight, both of you."
"Oh, I couldn't. Not without Hamilton."
"Of course you can," Theodosia said. "Your Jenny can watch over the babies, and Monroe can be your escort."
At that, Monroe stared at his feet. I cannot imagine that would be thought, well, at all proper."
Theodosia laughed, and the next word she spoke reminded me so much of Angelica.
"Perhaps not in your country of Virginia, but you're in New York now, a veritable vortex of folly and dissipation, if the gazettes are to be believed."
I ladled the thick golden batter into a hot iron. "Oh, be nice, Theodosia. Monroe is a very mannerly gentleman." I recounted how, upon my offering to help tend his wounded shoulder, he'd nearly tripped over my mother's sideboard table in fear my father would shoot him. Theodosia howled with laughter, while Monroe chuckled at the memory. And the impasse about our plans for the evening was solved when my husband stumbled into the house stamping snow off his boots, nearly crashing headlong into his old friend. I could scarcely contain my amusement when Alexander murmured with utter bewilderment,
"Monroe?"
The two men clasped hands, appraising one another from head to toe before clapping one another on the back with glad tidings. And within hours, Alexander had sent word of the reunion and called together an impromptu gathering in our dining room of Washington's young upstarts, a heaping plate of waffles between them. Colonel Burr appeared at dusk with whiskey, and these one-time brothers-at-arms talked late into the winter's night, telling old stories and debating how, in Monroe's words, we could cement the Union. I can never express how much good it did my heart to see these old friends and survivors of the war all together, laughing by a fire, Nor can I find words to say how much it hurts my heart now, knowing their friendships would come to a bitter, bloody end. June 1785, New York City.
British ship in the harbor!
Jenny cried, rapping excitedly on the bedroom door. And though such an utterance would have caused panic only a few years before, it was now, for me, a bringer of joy. One for which I'd been waiting for days.
It's a big one, mistress.
I was already dressed, my hair pinned. But I hadn't fastened my ear bobs or chosen a bonnet to match my dress, and in my excitement I didn't bother with either. Instead, I flew down the stairs.
My sister's here!
Alexander, on a rare day home from court, was holding Philip in the air and making our darling boy laugh.
You can't know if it's Angelica's ship.
Sisters, no, I insisted, rushing for the door.
I'll arrange for a coach,
Alexander called after me. But I didn't wait. I didn't wait for anything. Not even a parasol to guard against the summer sun. Instead, I took to the tree-lined sidewalk and ran the 5 blocks to the water and Burnett's Quay. As the bricks gave way to planks and mud, I dodged horse droppings, wagons, barrels, and giant coils of rope, the unmistakable scent of the river filling my every breath. I was sweating by the time I saw the ship moored to the dock, but I didn't care, because the 3 tall masts and rigging of that ship were as welcome a sight as any I'd ever seen.
Angelica!
I cried, bouncing on my feet and waving when she appeared out of the disembarking throngs, wearing a fashionable French straw hat with a striped ribbon and pink flowers in her hair.
Betsy!
We fell into each other's arms while servants scurried to collect her trunks and baggage and children. And we gazed upon each other with joy. She'd been gone nearly 2 years, and now I couldn't get enough of her. Alexander finally caught up with me and had nothing but warm smiles and affection for both Angelica and her husband, whose elusive disposition brightened considerably as Alex filled him in on all the latest goings-on about the city. That night, at a raucous, impromptu supper of cold ham with thick slices of bread and butter, we all crowded around my little table, laughing and drinking wine and singing together. And when I put my baby daughter, Angelica's namesake, into my sister's arms, I fell in love with both of them all over again. In a fit of exuberance, I said,
"Hamilton says there's a house for sale on Broadway. Mr. Carter, perhaps you could take it so we can all live closer together."
I blamed the wine in my overflowing heart for such an indiscreet suggestion. It wasn't proper for a woman to suggest a man what he should buy or where he should settle his family. But we Schuyler sisters had always nudged up against the line of what was proper and been adored by our husbands for it. So I was startled at the reaction. My brother-in-law scowled at me, and Angelica's musical laugh cut off abruptly, giving way to a gloomy expression before she stared down at my new china.
"A house on Broadway is a good investment,"
Alexander broke in, supporting my suggestion, as if he hadn't noticed the change in mood, or perhaps because he did.
"My affection for you both made me look forward to having you as neighbors." "We're only here for a visit,"
Mr. Carter explained.
"We've taken a townhouse on Sackville Street in London, where I intend to pursue a career in Parliament."
"London?" I choked out, shocked to my foundation. My sister's husband had made an outrageous profit in the war by equipping the Americans and the French, which could not have endeared him to his king. And even if that were not the case, there was the murky matter of what had caused him to flee England in the first place.
How can you expect to be welcomed there, Mr. Carter?"
I asked, fighting against despair at the thought of losing Angelica again, and after I'd assumed her return to be permanent. "Because Carter is only his nom de guerre," my sister said, finally finding her voice. "Allow me to introduce my husband, Mr. John Barker Church." My mouth fell agape. as Angelica explained in an unusually flat voice, that her husband was actually from a prominent family, and though he'd fled England under pecuniary, romantic, and legal embarrassments, he'd returned to Europe to learn that a man he thought he had killed in a duel was still quite alive, and now he was emboldened to return to the family fold. Ticking off the obstacles on her long fingers, Angelica said, "Jack is now respectably married, more than able to pay his creditors, and there are whispers that he'd be welcome in the Whig party." Her words hung thick over the table, like a net dropped from a sprung trap in which we were all awkwardly caught. Clearing his throat, Alexander tried to lighten the mood, raising a toast in honor of being able to live freely in this new world we'd created, and go by one's own name. I suspected, because of his dealings as my brother-in-law's agent, that he already knew his true identity. And though I held my tongue through the rest of the meal, I couldn't quite recover. "Did you know?" I asked that night, undressing before bed. Alexander's shoulders fell, answering me even before he took my hands into his.
"Yes. I'm sorry I kept it from you. It was a condition of my employment as his agent."
Even as unhappy as I was, I could hardly hold duty against him. "But he's a gambler," I said, allowing myself to be drawn against my husband's chest. "Jack Carter, Church, I mean, gambled himself into debt, he gambled on the war, and now he's gambling my sister's future in returning to England." I was being unkind, I knew, and unfeminine in expressing such an opinion upon a matter about which I knew too little. I thought my husband might scold me on both counts, but instead, he led me to bed, climbed under the covers with a book related to work he'd neglected during the day, and said only,
"I know you're worried, but let's try to enjoy the time we have with your sister while she's here."
So began a frenzied, near frantic social whirl, designed to squeeze every moment of pleasure out of Angelica's very brief visit. We went with our children on long walks about the city, attended balls and dinner parties and the theater, and we shopped. Or at least, we tried. Peering into the shop windows disapprovingly, Angelica frowned. "Oh, my poor country. I'm afraid there's virtually nothing that can be had here in the way of dresses, shoes, or women's fripperies that can't be found better or cheaper in Europe."
"That's because we currently rely upon foreign nations to manufacture our resources," Alexander said, denouncing the circumstance at mind-numbing length before concluding, "We send timber, flax, hemp, cotton, wool, indigo, iron, lead, furs, hides, skins, and coal. Our warehouses in the harbor are overflowing, but we will always be dependent until we can produce our own goods."
I gave him the indulgent smile I'd learned was the best response to his brilliance, if I ever hoped for his lecture to end. But Angelica seemed to actually enjoy these dissertations, and later gifted my husband with several books of economics as reward. Angelica felt no compunction against going to France's on Pearl Street, where Congress had rented space to debate whether or not they had sufficient power to form commercial treaties that would bind every state. And when I wondered if her husband minded, or if this wouldn't be looked at askance, she said, "The women in France do anything they like. Why, they are more avid on the subject of politics than their husbands." Knowing Angelica was to go on to Albany to see our family, and then to Philadelphia before taking her leave of America, I didn't want to share her with my friends and acquaintances, but they all clamored for her. Theodosia insisted we bring her to dinner, and it was no surprise that the equally outspoken and audacious Angelica and Theodosia got on like old friends. Likewise, Kitty Livingston's sister, Sarah, married to Mr. John Jay, pleaded with us to come to tea, where all the ladies gossiped about the prominent bachelors in town. Naturally, some of the talk was about Monroe. "Those gray eyes. That dimpled chin. That brawn. But Monroe is no great intellect. He'd be quite a nobody without the patronage of Mr. Jefferson. That's not true, I insisted, rising to his defense. Then I reminded them of Monroe's war heroism and service to the country until I was weary. And I was weary, because I couldn't keep up with Angelica. My sister was an indefatigable socialite. She accepted every invitation, holding court at every party. So the night my 10-month-old daughter was spitting up, and Angelica pouted because her husband's being out of town on business meant she ought not go without me, I said, Alexander will take you. And so they went, Alexander stumbling back into the house in the wee hours, complaining that my sister outdrank him, and retching over a chamber pot as he vowed that he would never imbibe champagne again. I thought nothing of it, until the next day, when, while shopping with Angelica for sundries in the marketplace, we came upon James Monroe in the shade of the awning of Mr. Mulligan's tailoring shop, in less than congenial conversation with my husband. I didn't wish to interrupt, but my sister twirled her parasol and fearlessly cried, Hamilton, I need to arrange for a sloop upriver, and you're just the man to help. Angelica laced her arm into the crook of Alexander's elbow, as was her habit. But to my surprise, my husband let his arm fall away in a most ungentlemanly fashion. Some manner of dark look passed between him and Monroe that I couldn't comprehend. Is my husband meddling in politics again, Congressman? I asked with a smile to Monroe. Monroe's jaw tightened, as if I'd asked him a very difficult question. But before he was able to offer an answer, he was nearly accosted by surly citizens who wished to complain about the latest debate in Congress. As I departed the scene with Alexander and Angelica, she glanced over her shoulder with disgust. What bumpkins! I don't see what you find so agreeable in Monroe. He's far too comfortable with the tobacco-chewing rabble in their knit caps crowing about liberty, while insisting anything beautiful or enjoyable must be banned, lest it destroy our revolution and deliver us into the clutches of monarchy. She wasn't entirely wrong about the rabble, but I believed her to be entirely wrong about Monroe. He's a man of relatively modest means, but he's no leveler, I said. Monroe proved it when, later that week, he joined us all at the long-awaited reopening of the John Street Theater. But while our merry band of companions settled into their seats in the gallery, Baron von Steuben insisting on a seat for his dog, I sensed Monroe's discomfort around our friends. You've been so quiet, Monroe. Unusually so, even for you. What weighs upon your mind? At that, his gray eyes lifted and met mine.
I'm leaving New York for a time.
I was sorry to hear it. Discounting that one strange moment outside Mr. Mulligan's tailoring shop, Monroe's presence and friendship had buoyed my husband's mood and made us all very happy, and I did not wish to part with him. For how long a time will you be gone?
3 or 4 months, I would reckon. Long enough to see all there is to see out west.
Out west? I exclaimed, my disappointment replaced with excitement for him. We'd shared a longing to see more of the world, and as he explained his intention to attend an Indian treaty in Ohio, then to explore the settlements in Kentucky, I could not help but long to see them too.
But before I go, Monroe added, there are a few things that weigh on my mind.
Thereupon he stared at my sister, where she stood between her husband and mine, laughing with the grace of an angel. And I sighed with pity, counting him as one of the many men who fell so helplessly under my sister's spell. You need a distraction. I laced my arm through Monroe's, patting his hand with great familiarity, and he groaned as if I'd tortured him.
Betsy.
Some emotion seemed to catch in his throat and afflict his tongue.
I would never wish for you to suffer.
He stammered, as if unable to spit it out until he blurted,
There are still those amongst us who give a care for propriety.
I was beginning to form some vague notion that Angelica and my husband must have violated some rule of Southern gentility. The always stiff Monroe never did understand our New York ways. Much less did he understand my gregarious family and our close-knit relations. I was grateful that my orphaned husband fit in so easily. Monroe, the man who nearly toppled Mama's sideboard because I offered to nurse his wound, never would have, I thought. And realizing how badly the man needed to be set topsy-turvy, I began to laugh. James Monroe, you need a wife, and I know just the introduction to make. I'd spotted the Courtright sisters, with beautiful Elizabeth in their midst, as they made so brilliant and lovely an appearance as to depopulate all the other boxes of the genteel men therein. By the end of the evening, Monroe seemed at least a little intrigued by the young beauty I'd befriended at Trinity Church. And in making an introduction between them, I counted it a night's good work done. I believed, perhaps foolishly, that whatever misunderstanding about my husband had worked itself into his friend's mind was wiped out in that powerful flush of infatuation with the girl who was later to become his bride. But I hadn't understood how stubbornly James Monroe could hold on to a thing, even a thing into which he had no business prying. No matter who it hurt, no matter whose life it destroyed.
Chapter 17. December 1786, New York City. A barrel of ham? I asked with a long-suffering sigh, as my husband rolled his wages into the kitchen where I stirred a thin vegetable soup. With three children now, the youngest, 7-month-old Alex, upon my hip, it was becoming harder to make do, a situation resulting from the fact that my husband preferred to take on charity cases or those that established legal precedents, instead of more lucrative but pedestrian disputes over trade.
A barrel of ham is worth more than continentals, Hamilton said in defense of himself. Besides, we can't eat a continental for dinner.
That is true enough, I thought as he took the baby and held him aloft. You make a persuasive argument, Colonel Hamilton. Tomorrow I shall cook up some ham and potatoes for us with the butter Papa sent from the pastures, and we'll invite the Burrs for a feast before church service. At this, he frowned.
Does your father send food to all his daughters?
I'd seen before how prideful he could be, and how much he chafed against anything that resembled dependence. So I said, Well, Papa can't very well send it to Angelica over the ocean, or it would spoil, but he's sent food to all his daughters before. Besides, without good butter, I can't replicate Mama's cookies for the children this holiday. Alexander didn't seem appeased by this explanation, so I tried to subtly remind him that we were bickering about butter because he insisted on representing impoverished persons.
Which client paid in pork?
The spinster lady I mentioned.
The one caught ceiling lace doilies, painted fans, and underclothes. Did she have some innocent defense?
No, he replied with a hint of chagrin. But I remember all too well what women must resort to when they're destitute and desperate.
At this declaration, at once so rare and revealing of the power his dead mother still held over him, I stopped stirring the soup and glanced over my shoulder. But the floridness of his complexion and his reluctance to meet my eyes warned me not to say any more about it. And I remembered that however spare our circumstances might have seemed to the daughter of Philip Schuyler, we lived comfortably, far more comfortably than my husband had as an orphaned boy all alone in this world. Our children were loved and cherished. They were fed and clothed and had a roof over their heads, thanks to Hamilton's talents. I couldn't call myself a Christian and resent him for using those talents to ease the suffering of others. Even the family in the West Indies of which he so seldom spoke. He'd made a loan to his estranged brother, who was too disinterested in us to write except when desperate for money. Money I was sure we'd never see again. Alexander even pleaded in vain for word from the father who abandoned him, so that he might render the old man assistance. That my husband also helped much more worthy persons, in my view, like impoverished spinsters, persecuted Tories, and downtrodden Negroes, was a testament to his good heart, and I both loved and admired him for it. In fact, I wished to be more like him. A few months later, one of my husband's troubled veteran friends came to our house in the middle of the night, drunk and unable to care for his motherless baby, a 2-year-old named Fanny.
"I'm sorry," my husband said when the knocking awakened me.
But I wouldn't let him apologize for the tender spot in his heart reserved for the soldiers he'd fought with, especially not since we'd so recently learned of Tench Tillman's death. Tench had never recovered from the cold he'd taken at the winter encampment of the army in New Windsor. It had festered into a lung ailment that killed him, leaving behind 2 daughters in Maryland, one of whom was orphaned before she was born. Alexander and I had wept together at the news. For if my husband would always have a tender heart for the soldiers he fought with, I did too. So now, by candlelight and in sleeping cap, I went down with Alexander to help his army friend and the child. I took the wailing red-faced girl to my shoulder, trying to console her, and some time later, after Alexander had seen his drunken friend to a sofa, I asked, "Will it be debtor's prison for him?" Alexander's expression was bleak.
"Worse. He's taken leave of his senses. He broke down in my arms, sobbing like a child himself. He has nightmares of the war."
I peered at little Fanny where she'd fallen asleep in my arms, dark lashes spread upon porcelain cheeks. And because I still had nightmares of the war, too, I couldn't stand for her not to be cared for as she should. "Alexander, what if we took her in?" We were too far away to render assistance to Tench Tillman's baby daughters, but perhaps we could help this one. We could keep her, just until her father can put his affairs in order.
"Oh, Betsy,"
my husband pressed a kiss to my temple and whispered,
"you are the best of wives, the best of women, and the best part of me. But I can't ask you to take on such a burden."
"I want to." As I stared at this man who'd once been an abandoned child, I became even more certain of my decision to take Fanny into our household. All children need love, and we are blessed to have more than enough to spare. July 3rd, 1787, New York City.
"This is a vile slander,"
Alexander said, crumpling a newspaper in a fury. We'd joined the Burrs on a visit to the new African Free School that my husband and his fellow members of the Manumission Society had brought into being to educate black children. And on the walk back, Alexander had purchased a gazette from a passing newsboy and become incensed by what he read.
"But no one of sense believes the rumor, my friend,"
Burr said in an attempt to pacify him. In the hopes that our countrymen had finally suffered enough that they were ready to see the wisdom in forming a true government, my husband had gone to Philadelphia with James Madison in May to serve as delegate for a federal convention to revise the Articles of Confederation. What Alexander and Jemmy wanted, I knew, was more than to revise them. They wanted to draw up a new constitution altogether that would provide for a stronger central government. But after only 2 months, my husband had returned, more frustrated than before, complaining it was a waste of time, and that he and Jemmy were thwarted at every turn. And now this newspaper article accusing him of conspiring to summon the Duke of York from England to start a new American monarchy. It was ridiculous. Burr was right that no one of any sense believed Alexander was trying to bring an English king over us again, but I already knew how much damage people with no sense could cause, and so did my husband.
"Ladies," Hamilton said abruptly to Theodosia and me, Please excuse me. Burr, will you see my wife safely home?
Where the devil are you going?
Burr asked before I could.
To find out who started this rumor.
Hamilton grumbled, waving the crumpled newspaper as he strode away on the cobblestone street.
Hamilton!
Burr called after my hot-tempered husband to no avail.
Will you go with him? I asked, exasperated, but hoping that Burr's measured approach to life would keep Alexander from trouble.
When Burr hesitated, Theodosia reassured him.
Oh, go, for goodness sake. Betsy and I can find our way without a guardian.
Burr chuckled, kissed his wife's cheek, then rushed after my husband. Watching them go, Theodosia sighed.
With rumors like that in the papers, sometimes I fear people are looking to start a civil war.
I fear it too, I replied. With Shay's rebellion, there already was a civil war in Massachusetts. It was spreading to other states, and it could happen here too, especially with Congress in session in the city.
Don't worry, Theodosia said. Burr will look out for your husband. He has a very good nose for the prevailing winds.
It's painful now to recall how reassured those words had made me feel. But they truly did, especially when she looped her arm through mine and said,
And in the meantime, we'll look out for each other.
That night, having slammed back into the house and awakened our sleeping children, Alexander was only mildly apologetic.
And did you hunt down the source of this rumor?
I asked, after putting the baby back to sleep. Alexander surprised me by saying,
I did, and it was a nobody. Just another indebted drunkard, a ne'er-do-well named James Reynolds.
There was nothing to be gained in quarreling with a man like that. Instead, Hamilton spent the days that followed directing his anger at our anti-federalist governor, Clinton, accusing him in a series of essays of poisoning the people's minds against reform, and against the convention in Philadelphia to which my husband would again return.
Are you sure that you should publish this? I asked, reading over his shoulder. You're drawing battle lines. Governor Clinton is a powerful man, and you...
You're a revolutionary, I thought, watching my husband scribble some note as if he hadn't heard me at all. He'd already gone against a king and won. He'd quarreled with George Washington and prevailed. He wouldn't be stopped by a governor. He wouldn't stop until he'd changed the world. And I wanted to help him do it. October 1787. En route to New York City. We went to battle in the bowels of a ship. Returning from a visit to my parents, we'd taken a cabin on a sloop bound for New York. And this narrow berth, with its single table secured to the wooden planks of the deck, and one porthole would be our war room for the week-long trip. There was just enough space for the children and their bedrolls, the gentle rocking of the single-masted boat lulling them fast to sleep. During the day, Alexander worked, and I took the little ones above deck to enjoy the passing scenery of towns on the shoreline, green pastures and blazing red autumn foliage. As I watched the children play and laugh and even bicker, my heart was torn between joy at their innocent hopefulness and sorrow at having learned the terrible and unexpected news that Peggy's little son, Stephen, had died in his sleep. Her husband had written that she was too indisposed to travel or receive visitors, so I hadn't had the chance to see her during our visit, and I ached to offer her what comfort I could. But by night, beneath the light of two lanterns swinging from the joists above us, I joined Alexander amidst his letters, treatises, newspapers, paper, ink, and quills.
My arms and ammunition, he quipped.
And who are we to fight?
Almost everyone, he said ruefully. The foes of the new constitution are many.
A few weeks earlier, my husband had returned from Philadelphia, where he affixed his signature to a blueprint for an entirely new government. He hated the plan. which he thought a hodgepodge of ideas and bitter compromises, particularly between the northern and southern states on the issue of slavery. But he'd said that without these compromises, no union could possibly have been formed, though Washington does not think this constitution will last 20 years.
20 years? Long enough for my sons to grow into men and get their educations. Long enough for my daughter to fall in love, marry, and have children of her own. Long enough for the new baby growing in my belly to get a good start in life. It had been only 10 years since my sister climbed out a window to elope with John Church, and that felt like a lifetime ago. 20 years of peace and stability would be enough, I thought. We could fix the rest. We could keep working to end the injustice of slavery and make the new nation live up to the ideals of the revolution. But first, we needed a nation. And 9 states would have to ratify the Constitution before it would become law. Alexander had a plan to make that happen. A secret plan. "We must defend the Constitution," he said, shuffling papers. "We must overwhelm the opposition with evidence and arguments. The Constitution is as flawed as some of my clients, but like them, it deserves a fair trial, at least in the court of public opinion." Resting a stack of books in my lap, I helped him clear a space upon which to write.
"And how are you going to make that happen?"
"With a series of essays," he said, the scratching of his pen competing with the creaking of the boat and the sloshing of the river against the hull. "Anonymous essays. Maybe 30 in all."
30?
I wondered how he'd manage such a thing, given the other demands on his time.
"So many?"
"There will be other writers, of course, though our identities must remain secret."
"Not secret from me, I hoped. Who will help you?"
"I don't know yet," he replied. "I intend to recruit John Jay, Governor Morris, and William Dewar."
Jay was an experienced statesman and judge, Morris a peg-legged bon vivant, the penman of the Constitution, and Dewar a wealthy New York legislator. "Not Burr?" I asked.
Alexander frowned. "Not Burr. He's not a man to commit himself to paper, even secretly."
I sensed even then there was more to it, but my husband was too caught up in his idea for me to interrupt.
"The trick will be to coordinate the essays without anyone catching wind of it. How to make our writing similar enough that no outsider can deduce who wrote what, and no single man can be vilified or lionized for it."
"Ambitious," I said. But I didn't realize how ambitious until we were at home, on solid ground, and I was awakened before dawn by the faint sound of knocking downstairs. Very familiar knocking. 3 quick raps, followed by 2 slow ones. I sat up in bed to find my husband dressing in the dark. "Is that?"
"Jemmy Madison," my husband said, grinning. "He's hurried back from Philadelphia to join the project."
I was confused because I thought the project was to be by New Yorkers for New Yorkers. "But he's a Virginian."
"Exactly, and we need Virginia to ratify, too,"
Hamilton replied, having adjusted the scope of the work by an order of magnitude. But I understood that if he was to build a whole country, he was going to have to persuade a whole country. By the time I'd dressed and seen the children down to the kitchen for a bleary-eyed breakfast of porridge under Jenny's watchful eye, I found the 2 men in the dining room, a stack of books and papers between them. It was a scene I'd witnessed 100 times. "Does my husband have you skulking about in subterfuge at strange hours of the day and night again, Mr. Madison?"
The pale little man smiled. "I owe no small apology for waking you and your servant, Mrs. Hamilton, but I received a message last night. We think we can deliver 4 essays a week now instead of 2.
Hamilton interrupted, slapping his hand on the table to punctuate that happy fact before looking squarely at me.
"With your help."
They explained that they desired me to act as a sort of courier, to collect the essays from the other men's wives, then deliver them to confidential intermediaries, who would pass them to the publisher in secrecy.
What thrill I felt to play a part in such a vast conspiracy.
But in the end, it was not so vast. Morris begged off. Dewar's first essay was so disappointing, my husband didn't wish for him to write more. And Jay felt terribly ill in early November, after I fetched his fifth essay at a tea party with his wife Sarah. That left just two men to write The Federalist, Alexander Hamilton and James Madison. And most of it would be accomplished at my dining room table. Every morning, Madison would walk from his boarding house on Maiden Lane to take an early breakfast, bouncing my children on his knee as he compared notes with Hamilton over strong coffee to sketch out the new work for the day. Together, they wrote words that became weapons in the fight to create a real union, fired off at a dizzying and stupefying pace to meet their weekly publication deadlines. My husband hunched over a desk, scribbling until his shoulders knotted and his lower back throbbed with pain. And many mornings, Madison's small hands literally shook with exhaustion as he tried to revive himself with my coffee after another sleepless night. I'd never before seen men exert themselves to the point of collapse by writing alone. But in those months, I witnessed just that. And in every spare moment I could find between housework, prayer, and looking after four unruly children, I read each word they wrote. If mankind were to agree to no institution of government until every part of it was perfect, society would become a scene of anarchy and the world a desert, my husband wrote. Echoed by Mr. Madison's simpler, if men were angels, no government would be necessary. On and on, working late hours between courtroom trials and congressional committee meetings, and nearly killing themselves doing it, they wrote the most enduring explanation of government ever put to paper before or since. As winter melted to spring, I witnessed their ideas grow like the child in my womb, day by day, and it made me bolder as if I, too, were on the verge of becoming. Which was why, one morning, looking over Hamilton's cramped shoulder, I ventured to say, Does that not seem... My husband turned to eye me, his brow raised. Yes. Fearing I was about to make quite a fool of myself, I bit my lip. Well, it's only that what you've written sounds quite identifiably like you. Hamilton's brow rose higher.
How?
It was dramatic, a little dark, and altogether too complicated. But what I said was, well, in the first place, you've used a great many more words to express that thought than Mr. Madison would. For a moment, his mouth dropped open, as if he took great insult, as if he were about to say something, perhaps something extremely cross. But his mouth snapped shut again, and all at once, he crumpled what he'd been writing into a ball and threw it to the floor. Crestfallen, I tried to retrieve it. Oh, no, Alexander, I didn't mean for—
Let it not be said, I cannot see through a veil of vanity, he said, grumbling as he started fresh.
Thereafter, I noticed their writing styles became much more similar, an achievement made easier by the fact that they were both so much in agreement about what remained to be written that it was no longer necessary to plan each morning. Anyway, there was no time to. As 29 essays expanded into 85, they burned through foolscap, parchments, quills, and slate pencils. Often, one of them was still writing while the other essay was being fit for type at the printer. There were days Hamilton didn't even have the chance to read over his own work before sending it off to press. And I myself scarcely had time for childbirth. 2 days after celebrating the delivery of a little boy we named James, after my husband's father and the man at whose side Alexander was now doing battle, my happiness was profoundly disturbed by my 6-year-old coming inside from a game of hopscotch with tears of rage streaking his cheeks.
They're calling me a quadroon, Philip cried.
I knew precisely why. Once, it was the question of whether one was a patriot or Tory that divided families, ruined friendships, and made nearly every outing confrontational. Now, it was the question of whether one was a Federalist or an Anti-Federalist, for or against a strong central government. Despite our best efforts, the authors of the Federalist essays had become an open secret. And even if the public didn't know which essays my husband wrote, they knew he was writing them. Which was why Governor Clinton sent his minions to retaliate in the papers, accusing Alexander of being a superficial, conceited, upstart coxcomb. They'd also called him Tom Shit, a reference to his illegitimate birth that implied he was a Creole bastard with Negro blood. And now, as I tried to comfort my crying firstborn son, a child of such sunny temperament that he almost never cried, it became deeply personal. Hamilton had warned me. He'd warned me when he proposed marriage that our children might one day suffer for the ignoble circumstances of his birth, just as I'd warned him not to pick a fight with the governor. But now it was war, and I wanted nothing but the governor's complete surrender. To that end, I decided to take the latest essay to the print shop myself, instead of waiting for the printer to come to the house to pick it up. I'd never been one to lay abed for long after childbirth, and I was convinced that activity was the only way to relieve cramps. Now, I wanted my little boy to walk the streets of this city with his head held high, and I needed to show him how to do it. So after nursing my newborn, I left him in Jenny's capable hands and took Philip for a short but painful stroll to the printer, then up Broadway past the hospital to the nearby apothecary shop.
"Mrs. Hamilton,"
the apothecary said in a scolding tone, his bushy brows knitted behind the counter.
"You're so soon out of childbed. I'd have come to you if you'd sent a servant or Colonel Hamilton to fetch me."
"I just needed some fresh air, raspberry leaves for my cramps, and a little lavender oil for my aching head." While I kept my curious boy from reaching for one of the many fascinating corked glass jars on the counter, the apothecary rummaged through the drawers, and we chatted about the various states that had ratified the Constitution, 6 by my count, 5 by his. "You forgot Massachusetts," I said, just as the roar of angry voices reached our ears. We both looked up toward the street to see a horde of angry men marching from the direction of the Battery. A mob. I'd once seen a group of men like this armed with feathers and tar. This time, they had sticks, and as I was about to learn, a far more righteous rage.
"Grave-robbing bastards!" someone shouted,
just before a brick sailed through the glass window, sending a spray of shards at my feet. Instinctively, I grabbed my son and pulled him behind the counter. But from where I crouched, I saw the swarm move right past us on the street. I could guess their destination. The hospital. For the Constitution was not the only divisive thing in the newspapers that year. It had been reported that medical students, in need of cadavers to dissect, dug up bodies in the Negro burial ground outside the city. No one of prominence had seemed to care until the corpse of a white woman from Trinity Churchyard was also dug up and stolen. Now the public was in an uproar. I knew the importance of cadavers to the field of medical science, but I couldn't help but shudder at the gross indignity of having anyone I loved violated and dissected in such a way. As we heard the crash of more windows farther down the street, the apothecary rose to wrap a sheltering arm around my shoulder.
"I'll get you and the boy home," he said, rushing us out the back.
Across the way, furious citizens broke the hospital door to splinters and overran the hospital, sending young medical students running in every direction. Over my shoulder, I saw a young doctor climbing from a window, and my son stared as shouting men hauled cauldrons of dismembered body parts out of the hospital, the stench of it recalling the war immediately to my mind. We saw a bloody foot, a swollen human head in a bottle, and some poor fellow's pickled genitals hanging from a string before we fled up Broadway, only to come against hundreds more furious men blocking our way. The jostling crowd swept us up like a tidal wave, separating us from the apothecary and nearly tearing Philip's hand from mine. Breathless and frightened, having quite forgotten about aches and pains, I realized the mob was descending upon the original nearby buildings of the old King's College, which had been recently renamed the more Republican Columbia College.
"Bring out the butchers!"
someone in the mob cried, and I knew they were looking for medical students to punish. "Keep walking," I whispered to Philip. But my son made of himself a dead weight, pointing with one hand at something I couldn't see. And then the crowd parted to reveal my husband on the college stairs, pleading with the mob to see reason. Hamilton was a great orator, and his military voice could just be heard over the fray.
"The mayor has already jailed the culprits. Allow the law."
The mob pushed past him, breaking open the doors to the chapel, the library, and the dorms of the college he'd recently helped reopen. Then he caught sight of us and dodged the rioters until we were all together, and he tugged us into his arms.
"Dear God, Betsy, what the devil are you doing here?"
The chaos gave me no time to answer, save to issue commands as he guided us through streets strewn with debris and damage.
"Stop, wait here, run!"
Alexander said no more until we'd made it into the safety of the Burr's entry hall.
Was that how my husband had led men across the battlefield at Yorktown? Fearless and relentless and cunning. Escorted by Colonel Burr, we finally made it the rest of the way home. Having no concern for our audience, Alexander took me into his arms so tightly that I could barely breathe.
"When I saw the two of you there amongst the rioters..."
"God willing, it's over now," I said, returning his embrace. But by morning, the mob had swollen to 5,000, a veritable army, double the number of men Washington had with him at the Battle of Trenton. Not that it kept Alexander nor John Jay, who'd just recovered enough to start writing Federalist essays again, from trying to reason with the mob. Jay got his skull cracked with a brick for his trouble. Likewise, the Baron von Steuben had been trying to persuade the militia not to fire at the rioters when he was struck by a stone and promptly changed his mind.
"Fire! Fire!"
I learned all of this when the Baron returned to our house, bleeding through a bandage hastily fastened upon him.
"Mein Gott! 20 dead!"
the Baron roared, almost as angry about that as he seemed to be about the ruined lace of his shirt. My newborn was just as angry in his cradle, crying for the milk only I could give him, while the Baron's greyhound licked my baby's face.
"How many more wounded, no one can guess. This chaos, this anarchy."
This was why the Constitution had to be ratified. An entire generation was growing up in a world without sure principles by which to live in peace. And I couldn't help but wonder, would my own son, after what he'd seen in the streets, come of age believing that there was no way to solve any problem but with a club or a pistol? Chapter 18. Summer, 1788, Albany.
"New Hampshire makes 9 states,"
Peggy cried, clapping her hands with glee. With Alexander in the New York Assembly arguing for the adoption of the Constitution, I'd taken the children home to the pastures to await news. And now Peggy prodded me.
"Why aren't you smiling? You said the Constitution only needed 9 states to ratify it."
"Officially," I said, swallowing hard against hope. Knowing how happy this news would make Alexander, and how devastated he would be if all our efforts came to naught. but it means nothing without Virginia and New York. If the largest and wealthiest states don't join this union, there won't be one. Our only hope was Jemmy Madison.